This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we're going to our Reporters Roundtable Thursday. First, talking with Lauren Cross, who is a reporter with the Times of Northwest Indiana. Lauren, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, yeah, thank you for having me. Well,
the great story that you and your colleague Sarah Reese have worked on involved East Chicago, and in particular the Calumet neighborhoods, either in the housing project or in the Superfund site. And you've got the Superfund site information for us to talk about today. And give us an idea, if you will, about how the city of East Chicago seems to be dealing with HUD and the projects that got put up, unfortunately, on the site of a Superfund site.
Yeah. So this has been on my radar for some time. As I had been researching, filing records requests with the city and HUD for, documents related to the city's housing rehab projects in the Superfund site. And HUD recently sent me some documents about 2 weeks ago, basically confirming what I had suspected, that the city wasn't fully investigating or even remediating contamination in the soil before carrying out these federally funded housing projects, which is, really, really, it's a big deal. I mean, they utilized federal dollars, and even though they knew this was a Superfund site, went ahead with the projects. And HUD says that this may have endangered families' health and safety.
Yeah.
Really fascinating.
Obviously, this goes back way past Mayor Anthony Copeland's administration, even past George Pabe's his administration. It goes back even further into, I guess, the last 10, 15, maybe 20 years?
Yeah, so HUD's review of the city's environmental review documents of project sites actually only go back to 2009.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. So the EPA has been investigating the Superfund site since the 80s. The Superfund site was listed in 2009, and this is a year prior to Anthony Copeland's election as mayor. EPA was well aware of it. I think the city has argued that they were not aware of how severely contaminated the soil was until, just 2 years ago last summer, when Mayor Copeland asked the residents to evacuate, basically relocate from the West Calumet housing complex. So yes, this has been going on for several years.
Your story goes into more detail about a little bit about history about the site as well too, and I know the concern that HUD has also now too, that and they've insisted, I'm sure, that the city of East Chicago has to let them know about any other projects within the Superfund site. But how far back did any of these housing projects go when they were built? Because we're dealing not only with contaminated soil, but probably in some cases contaminated buildings as well, too, I understand.
Yeah. So a lot of these, I think four homes were under the review that were newly constructed. And the homes were built about 2010, 2012. And HUD says that EPA should, or I'm sorry, the city of East Chicago should have cleaned up the soil. The city, just, to be fair, the city is arguing that, HUD's policies are unclear, too broad, perhaps, and EPA told them that they could move forward with these new construction projects as long as it didn't disturb the soil. So there's a little confusion there as to, who's really responsible. You have EPA, who's the primary responsible authority over the Superfund site, but then you have the city, a local government, carrying out these local projects. So that's some questions we still have, though. Some of these projects do go back to 2010, 2009.
How much rehabilitation do you think had been done or should have been done, even going back, to 2010, 2016 or something like that, even?
Yeah. I mean, there are about, I think, 14 sites that HUD flagged as needing remediation.
Mm-hmm.
And again, HUD's requested the city to disclose any other HUD-funded sites as well. We're talking about, toxic soil. We're talking about contamination that could potentially enter a child's system. It could also mean lead paint in homes as well, but it's not quite clear yet.
I know that in your story you talk about what information, I guess, that the EPA has passed along as well, too, and you talk here primarily about about HUD, but I know that the city is also aimed as well, I guess, to other agencies, including housing, for some of the problems that they've had to deal with the contamination here. And you talk about as well the inspection of the Superfund site as well, and I guess how the city really hasn't paid all that much attention to it, what they should be doing.
What's interesting is that, you know, in my research, I found the city, you know, does have a history of remediating soil and lead paint at properties with federal dollars. Mm-hmm. So this notion that the city, you know, didn't know or that they understood that EPA would just take care of it for them is a little perplexing. So I guess we'll see, you know, as we continue to research, investigate, see, you know, what exactly the city did know. So it's going to be interesting for sure.
Now, I know we have about a couple of minutes left here in our conversation today. What kind of response can you tell us, and you've discovered as well, it's in the stories, from the city of East Chicago to all of this?
Yeah, so I may have mentioned this, but the city, you know, largely has placed blame on the federal government here, you know, alleging that EPA told the city it was okay to work on these HUD projects as long as it didn't disturb the soil. They even showed me a letter. And to be clear, the city showed me a letter saying that EPA confirmed two of these newly constructed housing projects had clean soil. So there seemed to be some communication with EPA and the city about the contamination of those two sites. But it's also clear that the city knew of some level of contamination. These environmental reviews that HUD looked at clearly stated that these properties were in a Superfund site, and that alone should have warranted some investigation, some further review of the site before carrying out these projects.
We're talking with Lauren Cross, who's a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Her story that we were featuring here on Reporters Roundtable Thursday is one dealing with the City of East Chicago and Housing and Urban Development Department on the issues that involving policies as well as the problems of remediation and the fact that HUD is now claiming that East Chicago city officials shouldn't have been building any housing projects on what has been determined some time ago as an official Superfund site. And thank you very much, Lauren, for spending time with us today to talk about this, and we'll be looking forward to some more stories in the near future.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. We're continuing on with Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and let's turn now to Sarah Reese with the Times of Northwest Indiana and check in on more stories involving the city of East Chicago and the problems of the Superfund site there. Sarah, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I understand, first off here, that one of the stories that you had was the latest one we have is finding out the latest on who's responsible for some of the Superfund site cleanup. And six companies in particular have been named. Fill us in on how this process is going to go forth now that we've gotten all these six companies to, I guess, sign on to their official part of the cleanup work.
Well, I believe that they have to submit a work plan to finish the work. There's two different unilateral orders, one for soil cleanup and one that also includes indoor dust cleaning for the remaining homes in Zone 2 and 3.
Now, for our listeners, let's give us an idea of roughly what Zones 2 and 3 are, where they come into the picture there in the city of East Chicago.
So, with Zone 1, everyone, when you think of the Superfund site, probably got a lot of the attention early on. That's the West Calumet Housing Complex that's mm-hmm. now closed. Zone 2 is the middle part of the neighborhood. It's predominantly an African-American area. And then Zone 3 is the farthest to the east.
And that is, of course, that's a mix of nationalities there too, isn't it? We've got we have Hispanics as well as African Americans in that part of the neighborhood too, right?
Yes, it is more of a mix.
Okay, now I'll let you get back to explaining about the cleanup here. I know that you talked here about the companies who are involved in this part of the Superfund site cleanup. Would you name those companies as you've mentioned in your story?
Sure. Let me make sure.
I'll let you find your information there. I know there's six, and these are well-known companies. These aren't just small little family shacks, so to speak. These are big national or in even some cases multinational companies, aren't they?
USS Lead.
Right.
Atlantic Richfield, Atlantic Richfield is a successor to Anaconda, which is where the former lead smelter that the housing complex was built on top of.
Mm-hmm.
DuPont and the Chemours Company, which was spun off from DuPont. U.S. Metals Refining Company and Mueller Industries. Mueller, I think, after reviewing records, it looks like bought some shares of USS lead stock.
Okay. Now, bring us up to date, if you will, and you mentioned this in your story, too, about the cleanup work. How much lead and arsenic contaminated soil has so far has been taken away, and about how many properties do you think have been taken away so far?
Well, you know, I know that last year they cleaned up the soil at 109 properties in Zone 2 and 120 properties in Zone 3. Mm-hmm. They still need to excavate soil at 315 properties in Zone 2 and 111 properties in Zone 3. That work could take about two more years. They've also, as far as indoor dust, they cleaned up 47 properties in Zone 2 last year and 36 in Zone 3.
I know one of the other stories that you worked on also deals with potential, in this case, potential lead contamination. This is in Hammond, and mm-hmm. a factory that is well known in that area, and the Indiana Department of Environmental Management is getting involved in that. Give us an update on that, please.
Sure. It's a still an active factory. Actually, it's a lead oxide plant, and it's operated by Hammond Group, formerly known as Hammond Lead.
Mm-hmm.
So the Indiana Department of Environmental Management plans to do kind of a site investigation there, and they've identified a residential area to the north and northeast of the plant where they plan to sample soil and mostly city rights of way to see what the levels are. They haven't made any determination about what the levels are or that the area is contaminated. At this point, they say they're just investigating. And this site has not been referred to EPA yet.
Yeah, yeah. This is, for folks that are not familiar with it, this is a company that's located on 165th, kind of in between Indianapolis Boulevard and Kennedy Avenue, I know. And as you say, it's currently active. It's a very, very active business. And I guess it's unique, I guess, from what your stories have mentioned about the fact that it's a closed environment. What does that mean?
So the way that the executives explained it to me was that the trucks that they buy pure lead and it comes in a closed truck. So when they offload it, it's a pneumatic system and there's no exposure as it gets offloaded. And then when they load the trucks back up, it's also a pneumatic system and there's nothing coming out. It's all within this kind of they explained it as sort of a vacuum system.
Mm-hmm.
They're also kind of unique in the area because they have HEPA filters. In addition to their bag houses, the emissions that come out of the bag houses are then further filtered with HEPA filters. And they've had this technology since the 80s.
So they're very careful of knowing that there's potential contamination there. They're trying to do what they can, I guess, within the limit of the facilities to try to keep it as clean and least affect the neighborhood as least as possible, apparently, right?
Yes, the executive said that they've been careful all along since this plant came into operation in the 1930s. The HEPA filters came into use in the 1980s, so it's unclear if IDEM will find any legacy contamination there or not. IDEM isn't going to make any determinations or issue anything until its investigation is complete.
Okay. And the other story that you covered as well, too, for the Times of Northwest Indiana, deals not with lead necessarily, but with steel, in this case, U.S. Steel. And I guess the attorneys involved in raising questions about how the portage operation's been managed.
Yes. Actually, the attorneys, someone had sent an anonymous tip to us, and I asked the attorneys to take a look at this issue, and they did raise some questions about it. The wastewater treatment plant operator was issued a provisional certificate, which is, according to the IDEM records, kind of rare. And given the issues at the facility, the attorneys, said that they were concerned about the management. There was some issue about whether the operator, I'm sorry.
Okay. Now, is this all related to the Hexavalent chromium spill or leak, as I guess is put it, that ended up going into the Burns waterway? Is it not?
Right. And in documents, the company indicated to IDEM that the wastewater operator who had been in that position was reassigned after the October spill. Mm-hmm. And so now the new operator is the one who has the provisional certificate. So the attorneys were basically saying, you know, questioning the management, you know, that they are reassigning someone and then getting a provisional certificate, which is a kind of rare for a new operator. Why can't they find someone more qualified?
Well, there's some more great stories to come out from on that topic, to be sure. And we thank you very much, Sarah Reese, is a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And we hope to be able to follow up on these stories that you will obviously have in print as well as online coming up soon. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking, Reporter Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. 40 years ago, a blizzard, not nearly as bad as we've had lately. In fact, it was worse, much worse back then. The blizzard of 1978 is the subject of this program we're bringing you next, a very special program from Network Indiana.
There were no cars on the street. It was absolutely silent except for the sound of the winter.
January 25th, 1978.
It is rare to have a blizzard this far south in the Midwest.
A lot of Arctic air was spilling in from the north.
Snow.
So they called the town doctor, who was their best friend, and said, "Hey, Doc, we can't get a hold of the kids. They're out there alone. And could you see if you could get them?"
Wind.
Before our eyes, we were seeing things get covered up, and pretty soon it's blowing up over the shrubs and around the house.
Some people didn't have school for weeks.
The snow started on a Wednesday evening. The county highway department came through with a front-end loader and a grader. The snow caved in around the front-end loader.
Almost everyone was stuck inside.
I went to a good week. It might have been longer, but I just remember we were there out driving each other nuts.
Cabin fever.
And there was no bread. There was no milk. The shelves were pretty clean.
Colder than ice.
Got in his car and he was going down the road. You couldn't see hardly anything. And I'm there in my garage stuffing paper into cracks.
Danger outside and inside.
The mayor has declared a snow emergency, which will remain in effect, I'm told, until he calls it off.
An entire state challenged and stretched to capacity.
The Fort Wayne area, there was rock dropping food from helicopters.
You're about to hear it as it happened through archived radio broadcasts.
Where are you guys headed?
Up there, I think.
How many of these runs you had on this ship so far?
Oh, what?
Abandoned cars and cars left in teeming traffic lanes will be ticketed and towed away.
Through interviews with the people who saw it coming.
So we knew it was coming and stocked up a little bit.
Warned the people of Indiana.
I was afraid I was going to fall asleep and not wake up, so I called the city police department in Jasper and I said, "Hey, can you give me a wake-up call about 4 o'clock?
I think that's what's going to be on my gravestone. Here lies the voice of school closing."
And with the people who lived through it.
"You got to be kidding." He said, "Would you like one?" I said, "No, that's hard-earned beer. I'm not going to drink your beer after you walk 2 miles in a blizzard to get it."
There's a patch of snow on the ground.
40 years ago, Indiana and the blizzard of 1978.
There's a patch of snow on the ground.
Blizzard warning. You probably haven't seen one of those happen unless you're not from Indiana or you lived through the blizzard of 1978.
On January 24th, 1978, a storm system was coming together that would make everyone in the Hoosier State quite familiar with the term blizzard.
I'm Chris Davis.
And I'm Terry Stacy.
Terry, what's one of your memories from the blizzard?
Well, I was not quite 16 years old, a sophomore at Knightstown High School in Henry County, and we lived along US 40, the National Road, dairy farm across the road, and just about 3 or 4 miles from town. And as a teenager, I don't remember that there were any kind of blizzard warnings, which my mom and dad would probably tell you different. But as a teenager, I had nothing to think about other than my boyfriend. But we didn't really stock up on food, and my recollection is that it didn't really get started until out in Knightstown in Henry County. Don't remember it getting bad until until that evening. And my dad, here's one of my vague memories, my very clear memories, I should say, is my dad worked in Indianapolis at the Indiana National Bank Tower. And Knightstown is about 40 miles due east. And I remember my mom, as that snow was coming down and it was getting darker and darker, and my mom watching, sitting in that window, just wait and listening to WIBC and waiting for my dad to make it home in that snow. And it just kept getting later and later and later. And of course, no cell phones back then or any way to communicate. Once you're on the road, you're on the road. And he finally made it home. And then we were out of school for about 2 weeks. No electricity. 3 days into it or so, I remember my mom and dad hanging blankets from our living room in the open doors, hanging blankets. And then we all just slept and ate and lived in the living room where there was the fireplace.
Honey, Bob Gregory said it's going to be very cold out.
Hello, I'm Bob Gregory. You know,
Bob Gregory was a forecaster at Channel 13 WTHR in Indianapolis.
And our incoming anchorman was a fellow by the name of Paul Udell.
This guy, Paul Udell, he's supposed to be an anchorman. You know, where you sit and read the news. Only this guy doesn't sit.
I'm sure a lot of people probably remember the promos they had. Well, we didn't hire him for his legs or whatever. And the photographer's chasing him because he's always running around looking for a story. But we had gotten together up in Chicago because Paul was working CBS weekends in Chicago before he came to Indianapolis. And I remember him asking me, he says, well, hey, now how much snow do you get down there in Indianapolis? And I said, well, you know, usually normal year we'll get, you know, one, maybe two heavy snowfalls, you know, 6 inches or so. But that's really about it. So he was around when the blizzard of 78 hit in January 25th, and he says, somehow this doesn't sink in with what you told me a year or so earlier up in Chicago.
In the 1970s, TV weathercasts were done on physical maps, and they remember magnets and stickers.
This is Eyewitness News Center 13.
It was low-tech visually, but the meteorologist at the National Weather Service could tell something was up. Dave Tusick is a forecaster at the Indianapolis office and explains the recipe that cooked up the blizzard.
It was a storm system that originated out of Louisiana and therefore was pulling a lot of Gulf moisture northward with it as it was intensifying. And at the same time frame, a lot of Arctic air was spilling in from the north. And it's that contrast. The greater your contrast between cold and warm, the greater the potential for that storm to become a significant one, in this case was a record storm for Indiana.
Bob Gregory was on a mission the day before the blizzard.
I happened to be out at the National Weather Service office out at the airport in Indianapolis at that time. The day before, because we were working out an agreement to get our first radar for the station, which was a drop on the National Weather Service radar. One of the forecasters there came in and said, hey, guys, this just, you know, this is looking like we've got a major storm here, and I want to put out a blizzard warning. And, of course, that stopped everybody in their tracks and just looked at him, because blizzard was something that very few people have ever heard the word, hadn't experienced for a century, I don't think, certainly many generations.
Dave Tusek.
It is more rare when you typically hear about blizzards. They're more typical or more common out in the plain states and also along the East Coast, where the storm systems will tend to wrap it more intensively. The definition of a blizzard is one which your main criteria there are wind speed and also the amount of blowing and falling of snow that reduces visibility to near zero. And that's the result of that strong wind.
Al Scheib was one of the hydrologists for the National Weather Service Indianapolis office for over 40 years.
On the day the blizzard was going to happen, they put out a heavy snow warning that the morning of the 25th. Mm-hmm. It was the first about 17, 18 hours before the snow actually started.
He remembers the warnings.
Burt Reeves was the forecaster that issued the blizzard warning. Mm-hmm. Of the three offices, Ohio, or Cleveland, Chicago, and Indianapolis. Indianapolis put it out first.
The best advice is to complete all the travel that is necessary by early this evening. The snow is expected in the area by about 5 o'clock.
What you're hearing is the broadcast of the blizzard warning that went out on WIBC Radio in Indy.
Then stay home, stay off the roads, because after the drifting occurs, there is a high probability that many of the roads will be closed.
Lee Giles was the news director at Wish TV Channel 8.
We knew a big storm was coming over several days, but as opposed to 40 years later when we have all this sophisticated computer technology which can see these storms way out and what's going to likely happen, we had good information back in those days in 1978 in terms of the weather. We knew a big storm was coming, but I'm not sure that many people grasp how tough it was going to be.
Dick Crum, also known as Dr. Dirt, because he's been giving garden advice for over 50 years on WIBC in Indianapolis, went to the store for what everyone seems to want when a big snow is coming, but the cupboard was bare.
So I decided to go to the grocery store. When I got to the grocery store, there was nobody there, and there was no bread. There was no milk. The shelves were pretty clean because people had been listening to the radio and to the TV and things like that, and so they were prepared.
Seasons change with the scenery.
Coming up.
Is it easier to catch them in this cold weather or what?
The blizzard of 1978 arrives.
Not really, because our response times are down so far.
It's worse than anyone in Indiana has seen.
The mayor has declared a snow emergency, which will remain in effect, I'm told, until he calls it off.
You'll get people along my age, 50s, 40s. They say, oh yeah, we got snow coming. People react and they'll bum rush the grocery stores. And they'll clear the place out.
You're listening to Indiana and the Blizzard of
1978.
The first snow in Kokomo.
Because of the seriousness of the situation, we're asking the public to cooperate by staying home, staying warm, and staying off the streets.
Off in Indiana Highway.
A blizzard arrives in Indiana.
I was on my way.
You're listening to Indiana and the Blizzard of 1978.
We expect not only heavy falling snow, but after midnight, we'll have very high winds, gusting up to 40 miles per hour or so at times, and rapidly falling temperatures down to around 10 degrees by morning.
Part of the broadcast from WIBC on January 25th, after a rare blizzard warning was issued for Indiana by the National Weather Service. Some astute weather forecasters knew something was up a couple days in advance and started preparing the people of Indiana.
Indiana didn't get and doesn't get many blizzards.
As far as we can tell, at that time the office put out the general forecast for the entire state of Indiana.
Al Scheip is a hydrologist at the National Weather Service Indianapolis office and had just recently joined the staff when the blizzard happened.
So it was, as far as we know, was the first ever blizzard-wide warning for the entire state of Indiana. Unprecedented for the time.
He says the man who issued the blizzard warning did it, then went home.
Bert Rees went home. I left at 4 o'clock. I came in at 8 that day. And my primary concern was to get the Krogers to beat the lines of people, because milk and bread going to disappear just like that.
By the time this great storm of 1978 has passed us by the time it has left us alone, there will quite literally be thousands of stories that will be told, stories that will be passed on to children and grandchildren and nephews about the great storm of 1978.
Then Wish TV reporter Josh Littman.
Lee Giles was the news director at Wish TV in Indianapolis.
At Wish, we had our chief weathercaster, Stan Wood. I think it was on Monday before the 25th that Stan came to me in the newsroom one-on-one and said, Lee, I got to tell you, we're going to have a storm here, the likes of which no one in Indianapolis or central Indiana has ever seen. seen.
And what about getting people to work?
In fact, the only way Channel 8 News crews were able to get around during the night was in a single four-wheel drive vehicle lent to us by Northside AMC.
So one of the things that we did, I'm looking around and I'm thinking, gosh, we don't even have any four-wheel drive vehicles to cover this. We hadn't been able to convince management that we were in that kind of a snow belt where we need four-wheel drive. So I asked one of our aggressive young reporters, Josh Lippman, to call around and see if he'd get somebody to loan us a four-wheel drive vehicle. Tuesday night, he went out to an auto dealer, and they not only gave us a vehicle, they loaned us a brand-new Jeep SUV four-wheel drive.
WIBC's Dick Crum, who's a horticulturist and just recently retired from the Home and Garden Show after 53 years, heard the warnings on the 25th.
Man, it seemed like there was a mad rush out of town. I normally left at about 4:30, and 4:30 on the interstate was pretty bad. And then when I got, I lived 12 miles from work, and when I got home, of course, in subdivision, they don't plow that out until the next week. Went home, and snow still coming down.
Well, I lived in the country, like I said, about halfway between Anderson and Muncie.
Eric Zimmerman was in high school. He remembers the first day of the blizzard. He later became a forecaster with the National Weather Service.
Although it was only a quarter mile away from a state highway, the snow and the wind combination caused such drifting on that quarter mile stretch of a country road that we were snowed in for a week and a half. The snow started on a Wednesday evening.
I thought it was cool.
Carla Wells, who lived in the country when the blizzard happened.
So, of course, I was 12 and got out of school, and, you know, I thought it was cool.
We were ready for a big storm. I was a senior in high school.
Dennis Handley lived in Indianapolis.
And I was hanging out at a buddy's house, and we were just waiting for the storm to come and hanging out together, watching the snow fall. And then I got a call from my mom at his house that she wanted me home, and so I was out in the storm walking home. I was only a couple blocks from home, and I had come dressed for it. I had a winter, had actually my dad's old Navy pea coat on, and it was a heavy, thick wool coat, and I had a scarf and a hat, and I pulled it all up tight and walked home in the middle of a blizzard.
It was a slow go, but he had to do what Mama said.
I was two blocks from home. I knew every step of the way home, and it didn't matter whether I could see or not. There was nobody on the roads. It was just me and the storm.
I was a nighttime announcer working 7 to midnight.
Gene Kuntz has been with WITZ in Jasper since before the blizzard. He knew that the people in Jasper and the surrounding communities of Huntingburg, Velpen, Ferdinand, Holland, and Otwell needed info about school and business closings, and that they needed a voice during the storm.
The snow came down that night. I was working, and it started piling up, and the wind was blowing, and I looked out in the parking lot, and my car was snowed in, and the snow was deep everywhere, and I said, you know, there's no way I'm going to be able to leave here tonight. So I said, I'm just going to stay on the couch. So I called our morning guy, Tom Holliday, who was living in Paoli at the time, and I said, Tom, I said, there's no way you can get in the morning. I said, I'm just going to stay. I'll stay, sleep on the couch, get up in the morning, and I'll sign on.
Wherever you are, you might remember your local radio station being the place to get information and being the companion through the blizzard, or giving you information now when storms happen. Kuntz says community radio is still important.
Well, there's nothing like that because, you know, back in 1978, they relied on local radio for weather information, school closings, factory closings, all that type of thing. And, you know, we're still a full-service radio station, you know, giving that kind of information. And we do it every day. And it's just what community radio is all about.
And TV was important, too. Around-the-clock storm coverage wasn't necessarily how TV did it in 1978. But Bob Gregory, weatherman at WTHR Channel 13, says they had been telling people about the storm before the blizzard warning came out.
So we get on the air and telling people to prepare. We didn't have that much snow, well, 15 and a half inches of snow in that particular storm. So the snow was significant. But the big thing was wind chills that were in the minus 40 and at times minus 50 categories. People, you know, had somewhat of a chance to prepare, but they really weren't sure, you know, what am I preparing for until the full brunt of this thing hit with the wind and the bitter cold and all the people losing power.
And the flakes started flying. The wind picked up and blew at over half the force of a hurricane. Al Scheip left the National Weather Service office and beat the storm home with a pit stop first at Kroger.
It was like 4:35 in the evening on the 25th. It started snowing. You see a flake of snow here. 7 o'clock at night, I realized what the blizzard warning meant because my neighbor, next door neighbor, for whatever reason, got in his car and he was going down the road. You couldn't see hardly anything. And I'm there in my garage stuffing paper in the cracks saying, okay, I know what's going to happen now.
For some people in Indiana, there was little that could be done.
Evansville had one snowplow. They had one snowplow. So obviously they were not prepared.
By the time January 25th ended and January 26th began, snow was piling up.
It was a fierce storm. I mean, walking home in it was a really interesting experience.
Dennis Hanley.
It was like the world had come to a stop, and the only sound was the falling snow and the blowing wind. And there were no cars on the street. It was absolutely silent except for the sound of the winter.
In Jasper, Gene Kuntz was at WITZ watching the snow pile up over the cars in the parking lot as the wind howled. He was the only person at the radio station and stayed on as long as he could.
Well, I did until like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. Back then, we used to sign off at midnight, and there was no coverage on, from midnight to 6. I know it was an emergency, but I stayed on the air till about 2 o'clock in the morning, and the phone finally stopped ringing.
Then it was time for some sleep, even if it was just for a couple of hours.
And I was afraid I was going to fall asleep and not wake up, so I called the city police department in Jasper, and I said, hey, can you give me a wake-up call about 4 o'clock or 4:30, just in case I fall asleep, so that I can get up and get back on the air again? And I woke up about 5 minutes till 5, and all of the phone lines were ringing, and I just got up and hit the transmitter, and away we went,
That was the first snow in Kokomo.
Coming up, what happens when you get 20-foot snowdrifts locking you in place for days?
We all knew that we were not going to be going to school for a couple of days.
And whatever gets you through the storm.
Anything of romantic activities was the furthest thing in my mind.
You're listening to Indiana and the Blizzard of 1978.
Good evening. New England tonight is struggling with the worst snowfall in its history.
Indiana wasn't alone in the blizzard of 78.
A raging blizzard that came in on winds of up to 100 miles an hour, bringing death and destruction to the whole region.
Snow.
You're listening to Indiana and the Blizzard of 1978.
I'm Chris Davis.
And I'm Terry Stacy.
I want to wash my hands, my face, and hair with snow.
Northeast Ohio shut down by the first major blizzard of the new year.
It took a few days, but the blizzard blew into Ohio.
Rush hour traffic at a standstill on some of our major highways. We'll have a live report.
And then into New England and the East Coast.
70 people died in the storm all over the eastern half of the country.
And what would happen if a storm like this happened when it was warm?
Well, certainly a storm of this magnitude would more than likely cause an outbreak of severe weather.
Dave Tusek with the National Weather Service.
Widespread severe thunderstorms, probably lots of significant tornadoes, just given the dynamics, how strong the system was, and during the springtime, a similar storm like that, it would be a major tornado outbreak.
Please do not call any law enforcement agency, sheriff or otherwise, with frivolous questions. Yes, the roads are all closed. Yes, the interstates are all closed. Yes, the airport is closed.
By the second day of the blizzard, snow was already covering Indiana. The wind that came with it had huge snowdrifts piled up over cars and even up to roofs on houses.
We've had plenty of other snows in different parts of Indiana that had nearly as much snow, but it was not the long, sustained wind. I mean, we had 50-mile-an-hour winds for over a day, 24, maybe almost 48 hours.
Eric Zimmerman, who was in high school at the time.
The house I was living in with my parents at the time was a one-story house. And I remember finally getting out.
He later became a forecaster at the National Weather Service.
The blizzard was Wednesday night, most of Thursday. I remember finally getting out, I think it was on Friday, and one of the drifts went to the roof. Had my father allowed it, could have easily sled it off the roof down onto the on the ground eventually.
Bill Ludlow was a volunteer firefighter in Lawrence.
My wife and I, we didn't live too far from our jobs at that time, and she said, we ought to try to go. I said, no. They said no. Then she tries to go out and get the newspaper that morning. She comes back in. She couldn't even get the door open. because the snow was so, you know, heavy or so piled up. And she comes back in and she said, we're not going anywhere. So for like the next 2, maybe 3 days, we were locked in our duplex that we lived in.
It began getting worse and worse and eventually very impassable. And we began all trying to get to the interstate, to the interchange at this Ross Point Plaza. And as we got nearby, why, the vehicles became bumper to bumper and impassable. And then we all had to walk in.
Part of WIBC's broadcast during the storm.
WIBC. We did the morning, and obviously I did the school closing.
This guy gets up in the middle of the night, and he's already working while you struggle out of bed.
I think that's what's going to be on my gravestone. Here lies the voice of school closing.
It's either going to be a Clyde or Gary Todd.
Gary Todd was the morning host on WIBC.
Ironically, I had taken delivery of a Blazer four-wheel drive from Bill Estes the day before. And Bill, one of the last things he said is, you know, unless there's a really bad snowstorm and maybe the county comes by, because we lived out at 86th and Sargent out in the, well, at that time was the country. And he said, maybe you'll have to put it in low lock to get through that. Well, the house was up on a hill. So I backed it in the garage and went out, and I wanted to go early because I know it was snowing then, and I got up and went out about 3:30 or quarter to 4. I had to put it in low lock to get out of the garage and down the hill.
His drive into the station was surreal, he says.
I don't think I saw 5 cars on the way in, and I saw abandoned vehicles as I got down to 465 and 37. On some of the on and off ramps, the car is just abandoned.
Please stay put. Don't try to go out on the road. Something we must reiterate, the people that go out are taking a chance.
You can see footage on YouTube from Channel 8 of police ticketing cars that were abandoned.
Chances are you won't get but about 6 blocks from your home. You'll have to leave your car at that point and hoof it back home. Okay? As soon as the weather does let up, all of these cars that are blocking roads and blocking intersections are going to have to be towed away before the heavy equipment can come in and clean the roads off. So this is just going to delay the operation, maybe even another 24 hours. So for goodness sakes, just stay put.
Due to 40 miles an hour gusting winds, streets are virtually impassable. All citizens should stay off of city streets unless absolutely necessary.
The blizzard was life-threatening all through the Midwest. Bill Ludlow, volunteer firefighter.
How many people did you rescue?
I don't even know what the number is, but what we would do when we would have to transport people to the hospital, we would take the fire truck and follow the ambulance or lead the ambulance down to the hospital because the roads were so thick in case they got stuck, you know. And we had, at one time we did transport somebody in the fire truck because the ambulances were all out busy.
Contrary to the myth that says there's a population boom after 9 months after this because everybody's stuck at home, the day of the 26th, that was the, anything of romantic activities was the furthest thing of my mind because the wind was blowing constantly at least at 35 mile an hour, gusting to 55 at times.
Al Scheif with the National Weather Service.
You didn't hear a word nationally about what was going on in Indiana until head track train from Chicago got stopped by a 14-foot rip.
Okay, what is the situation on that one more time? You're planning to take them all off the train now?
Right, we're removing them on this snowplow train. It says two engines together, which came up from Bloomington in an attempt to remove the dislodge the other train. They couldn't do so, so now they're transporting 20 to 25 people at a time back to Bainbridge, where they're being housed at the gymnasium and the fire station. We still have approximately 40-some on the train. We do have reports on the first load that there is some frostbite.
In northeast part of the state, the Fort Wayne area, they were brought dropping food from helicopters. They were taking expected mothers via snowmobiles to the hospital. There was nothing was moving.
People are having difficulty getting out of their driveways to come here and help us operate our equipment. We're having difficulty getting out to pick them up so that they can help us out in accomplishing our mission.
Lieutenant Mike Ross with the Indiana National Guard.
Even when they are out, our four-wheel drive vehicles are getting stuck and so forth. so we're doing the best we can to handle life and death situations only.
Then Mayor Bill showed up, Bill Hudnut, and Mayor Bill was brought out to the station and they made some rounds by the National Guard. I forget what kind of all-terrain vehicle they had.
Gary Todd, host of Gary's Place on WIBC.
And he came in and I'll never forget he had his racer's stocking cap on.
I am declaring a snow emergency because we really have no reasonable alternative. What it really means is that we're asking John Q. Citizen to stay at home unless there is a extremely critical reason to take him out. This is unfortunate because it does mean the loss of business in some areas. The weather has already closed down most business. We're asking the public to cooperate by staying home and staying warm and staying off the streets.
And of course, no school.
We lived in the country, so we were basically snowed in. There was no way you were getting on the roads. You couldn't get out. You couldn't do anything.
Carla Wells.
My dad was the postmaster of the Franklin Post Office at the time, and he had a friend come and get him on a snowmobile. I remember picking him up and taking him in there to, I don't know why, the mail wasn't moving, but like he would spend the night at the post office for like 3 days until we could get dug out.
Keith Johnson lived in Lagodi.
There was a hill just down the way by a junkyard, and we called it Roscoe's Hill, and it was like a ski slope. Of course, no one could drive that thing, so it was just packed with great snow, you know, like feet of snow. And so us and the kids out there, we got our flat-bottom toboggans out and ramped down this thing and out, crossed into the highway with no worries because there was no one across the highway.
James in Fort Wayne.
Three TV stations. My little sister is about a year and a half younger than me, and my imagination outside in that snow, that was about it.
Terry, you didn't have school in Knightstown.
We didn't see kids for a long time, felt like. Living in Knightstown, where we lived, for 2 weeks out of school, we felt very isolated. Very isolated, and I couldn't wait to get back. Couldn't wait to get back to school.
I'll soon be there with snow. I wash my hair with snow.
Coming up, the light at the end of the tunnel, literally.
While they had most of the roads cleared, the plows had not rounded the corners off at all. And so the long school buses couldn't turn corners.
And the lessons from living through the monster storm.
It was a tough full time, but as a kid, it was like a fantasy land.
You're listening to Indiana and the Blizzard of 1978.
Snow.
There's a blizzard coming on. How I'm wishing I was home.
You know, some places were encountering drifts of 10 and 20 feet high.
Listen to that northern sigh. If we don't get home, we'll die.
When the clouds cleared, I mean, 2 minutes later, right behind them with these strong winds coming out of the north, they're just stacked it all up once again.
You've probably seen some really cold winters, but unless you've lived through the blizzard of 1978, you've probably never seen snow up to the roof and driven your car down a highway with snow taller than the car on either side.
Some of the snow drifts were just that big on January 27th, 1978.
You're listening to Indiana and the Blizzard of 1978.
In Indianapolis, the police were busy. If you went against advice and tried to drive out into the storm and had to abandon your car, they were writing tickets.
All of these cars that are blocking roads and blocking intersections are going to have to be towed away before the heavy equipment can come in and clean the roads off.
Burglaries, liquor stores, and drug stores.
Have you been particularly successful at catching anybody yet?
For the A-team, I think we've been doing pretty good.
Is it easier to catch them in this cold weather or what?
Not really, because our response times are down so far.
And ambulance crews were having a tough time getting to patients.
Where are you guys headed?
Up there, I think. Overdose.
An OD?
Yeah.
Do you guys get stuck that often?
Oh, Christ, yes.
How many of these runs you had on this shift so far?
Oh, lots.
Here, what's the situation there in Frankfort as far as you know?
Our National Guard armory is not open. Nobody has the key.
Has anybody considered trying to break into the thing?
This officer called in earlier today and said that they could be court-martialed and face a firing squad if they did.
We got power, but it was about the time they were getting ready to plow the road to get us out.
Carla Wells lived in the country.
How long was it before things kind of went back to normal?
Probably, well, the mounds and mounds of snow were always
was there, and the town got going again 3 weeks.
Terry, you remember finally catching a bus to school after a couple of weeks.
My mom remembers very distinctly the farmers, all the farmers coming out to help everybody plow out. It took quite a long time. Buses, even after we went back to school 2 weeks later, buses still had trouble getting down those rural county roads because the snow was taller than the buses in a very narrow path.
To see the Indiana sky.
You would go out and you would see people trying to help their neighbors.
Bill Ludlow was a volunteer firefighter in Lawrence. Just like Terry's mom, he remembers people helping each other once the blizzard stopped.
If your neighbor's in trouble, you know, you go and help them. You know, you've seen kids out, you know, trying to shovel snow and everything.
It was amazing how when we'd go out to do some coverage and do some stories, people were out there helping their neighbors.
Lee Giles was news director at Wish TV.
That was the theme that went through this coverage altogether, that people just helped each other and came together. And I think it led to a feeling about living here that has remained with us all that time, that this is a great place to be, to live.
Yeah, eventually people started wanting some things, and we volunteered to walk that way.
In Marion, David Allen was a high schooler and says he wasn't afraid of much.
One of the neighbors had a couple sets of World War II snowshoes, so he strapped them on me and his son, and we trudged out to town about a little over a couple of miles to a Handy Andy store, and with our list of things to get, it was a pretty crazy walk.
You were just assuming at that point that the store would be open.
Yeah, really, we were just hoping that it would be open.
Neighbor came over and asked me if I needed anything at the store, which was a mile away.
Dick Crum.
Wilbur took off, and about 2 hours later, he came back, and on his shoulder was a case of beer. And I went out, and I said, I thought you were going for food or something. He said, no, I got plenty of food. I said, you just ran out of a beer. I said, you got to be kidding. He said, would you like one? I said, no, that's hard-earned beer. I'm not going to drink your beer after you walk 2 miles in a blizzard to get it.
When the storm left Indiana and blew into Ohio and into the eastern states and New England, it was time for Indiana to dig out.
Of course, it was snowed in for a week and a half, was out of school for 2.5 weeks. While they had most of the roads cleared, the plows had not rounded the corners off at all, and so the long school buses couldn't turn corners. So the county then had to come around the next week and spend time rounding the corners, essentially, so the buses could get through.
Eric Zimmerman was in high school.
Somehow or another, either my school system had enough days added in or gotten a waiver from the government. I don't recall how it worked then. But they required us to make up 2 days. So they said, okay, we're going to cut your spring break down by 2 days. We went that Monday. That Monday night it snowed. They had to cancel school that Tuesday. And we never made up that one last day.
You might wonder what would happen now if a similar storm blew into Indiana.
It wouldn't just be a television experience. It would be a Facebook, a Twitter, IndieChannel.com experience, and it would be shared.
Kevin Gregory, Bob Gregory's son, is the chief meteorologist at RTV6 in Indianapolis.
I remember going to work with my dad, and you had a physical national map, local map, Midwest map. You'd put magnetic temperatures and cold fronts on the map.
He says forecasting today is much more specific.
We're giving you a time and location specific forecast. And so I think that's the greatest change from back then.
And getting you prepared is quicker and better, says Bradley Thatcher, Director of Response with the Indiana Department of Homeland Security.
The huge difference between 1978 and what we do now is that we have much better technology. We have the availability of warning the public much quicker.
He says people are much more weather aware.
With the advent of smartphones, people can get forecasts and they can get weather emergency alerts 24 hours a day with them wherever they're at.
And you might wonder, could it happen again? Dave Tusek with the National Weather Service.
It's in many folks' lifetime the only substantial blizzard that to have impacted Indiana. In a sense, you could call it maybe a once-in-a-lifetime event, but with the right conditions coming together, another one could happen here again.
It's had an impact on me because I'm always ready for a week's worth of whatever could come.
James in Fort Wayne.
Before then, if you said there was snow coming, people really didn't do a bunch of stuff. I think after that storm, you kind of saw a change in people's attitude because you'll get people along my age, 50s, 40s, 60s. They say, oh, yeah, we got snow coming. People react and they'll bum rush the grocery stores. and they'll clear the place out.
On a winter Sunday I go to clear away the snow.
You've been listening to Indiana and the Blizzard of 1978, written and produced by Chris Davis.
It was a good time to read nursery catalogs.
Interviews by C.J. Miller, Kurt Darling, Ashley Fowler, and John Herrick.
It just is one of those once-in-a-lifetime opportunities that I really don't want to have to go through again.
Archive work by Ashley Fowler and Henry Davis.
I was expecting to be stuck one day, you know, when you get up and you see nothing is moving. You say, you're going to be here till they dig it out.
I'm Chris Davis.
I'm Terry Stacey.
Oh, January.
You need that drink of brandy till you're finished in the house where it's nice and warm. Then it can be of some benefit.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. Thanks to our panelists, reporters from Lauren Cross, as well as Sarah Reese from the Times of Northwest Indiana. And I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us. We'll be back with you with Regionally Speaking on Monday.